Hello and welcome to Power Pros Podcast, episode 123. I'm your host, The Hoff, Chris Hoffman, and with me is this week's guest co-host from Player One Podcast, Ethan Einhorn.
Hey Chris, great to be back on the show.
Glad to have you back. It's always a pleasure. Of course, we are back once again to talk about what's going on in the world of Nintendo. We've got some impressions, some previews, some crazy news to talk about, and then we've got this week's big topic, which is going to be game localization. Before that, though, let's kick things off by discussing our hands-on time with some demos of games that will be available very soon. First up, we've got Dragon Quest Builders for Switch. This game hits on February 9th, but the playable demo is out now. And I have to say, I've been pretty impressed by what I've played so far. This demo is very extensive. It's at least a couple hours long. And you know, I've never played this game on other platforms before, but it gave me a really good feeling of having an excellent mix of Minecraft-like construction, real-time monster fighting with slimes and other Dragon Quest baddies. And then it also has, you know, this great trademark DQ aesthetic with familiar characters and items and music, and I've been pretty impressed. Have you played the demo yet, or have you played this game in any form? And if so, what do you think?
Yeah, I have. I have actually purchased the game twice already. This is going to be the third time. But to be fair...
So you like it?
I do, yeah. To be fair, it'll be only the second time that I end up keeping it. See, I bought it originally on the Vita, and then I picked it up on PlayStation 4, assuming that it would have cross-save, which a lot of the games that are on both of those platforms did.
Or transfaring, as the kids call it.
Transfaring, exactly. But apparently the draw distances were different on the game, and they were not able to make cross-save work. And so as a consequence, I just ended up returning the PS4 game. But it's great that I can finally get that on-the-go and at-home experience with the Switch, which, of course, is the biggest selling point for turning it on and playing it again.
Okay. Yeah, so if you're going to get it again, obviously you liked what you played.
I did. Actually, playing Minecraft, I've always had a difficulty with Minecraft where really get into those experiences at the start. But once I end up building my safe space, my house or my cave, and I can readily go in and out with a door that I can use, and it's just kind of on me to figure out what to do next, I just lose interest. And that's happened to me multiple times on multiple platforms playing Minecraft. I really like with this game that they have more of kind of that Skyrim or Xenoblade type of progression where you're constantly being given new quests that give you a good idea of what you can do next to further your game.
Yeah, I tend to agree from what I've experienced so far. It seems to have a good sense of progression. It seems to have just the right amount of guidance, but it doesn't really dictate too much. I mean, it seems that for the most part, you're kind of free to build however you want, but you do keep getting these quests and suggestions that sort of point you in the right direction.
Yeah, yeah. I think also it's important to state that this isn't just a Minecraft-alike. It's in third-person perspective. It is a different art style. And as Chris, you said, it also has some more meaningful battle components, I think, than Minecraft did. So definitely something that is worth playing, even if you already have and love Minecraft. But if you like the kind of idea of Minecraft but never actually got into the game long term, this might be the take on that type of experience that you've been looking for.
I've actually never been that interested in Minecraft, but I am, no pun intended, digging this. It makes me think I should give Minecraft another shot. But I have to say, the one thing that I don't like about either game so much is this very, very blocky aesthetic. So I'm kind of eager and anxious to get around to some part where I'm creating some structures that aren't just looking like big piles of blocky dirt.
I can totally understand that. That definitely makes sense. Again, the game does open up, but the fundamental of the game, you do get that basic experience within the first couple of hours. So the game isn't going to change dramatically. So, you know, do bear that in mind. But I think that as an early release for 2018, it's coming out at the right time. There's not going to be a ton of competition. It's just before Bayonetta 2 comes out, which is the one that I'm most looking forward to for February. And so, yeah, I think that it's definitely not going to be competing too heavily with other titles, and it's worth digging into.
Yeah, I mean, right now it's fun. I totally want to play more. You know, I'm kind of on the fence as to whether or not I'm going to buy it based on the demo, but I certainly like it and impressed. And for me, like, the biggest obstacle is that I'm still in the middle of playing Xenoblade, and I probably have like another 100 hours to go in that title.
Yep.
But if I were to get through that, then Dragon Quest Builders is definitely one that would be on my list, because it is quite enjoyable, and I suggest everyone go and check out this demo. There's really no reason not to, and I'm just kind of blown away by how much content there is in it.
Yeah, it's really nice when they give those meaty demos. I remember that's what converted me to buy the wonderful but terribly named Bravely Default.
Uh-huh. Yes, that was a good one too. However, on the other side of the RPG spectrum, we have Lost Sphere, which is also coming for Switch. This one is from Square Enix and Tokyo RPG Factory, and it is a traditional turn-based RPG from the makers of I Am Setsuna. In this game, you play as a character named Kanata and his friends as they, according to the website, set out to restore the lost with the power of memory. An ominous power is threatening the fabric of reality itself, and it is up to you to put a stop to it.
You know, I Am Setsuna is a game that I picked up at launch.
Mm-hmm.
I obviously didn't get to it immediately because there was another big action RPG.
Yes.
That I think we were all trying to finish.
Yep.
But even when I finished Zelda and tried to sit down and enjoy Setsuna, I appreciated the art style. I appreciated the kind of old school battle system. But I never got more than 4 or 5 hours in before dropping it. I just couldn't get into it. It didn't have enough depth.
Hmm.
So how does this game compare?
Well, I've never actually played I Am Setsuna, but I will say that just the demo itself for Lost Sphere did not leave me terribly impressed. You're just sort of thrown into things without much explanation. You don't really get any background about the characters. You don't really know who these people are. You seem to be in the service of some dubious empire trying to put down some rebels, but that's just sort of what I infer through the dialogue. They don't really set you up with an introduction. And when you get into the combat, that can be pretty fun. It uses the old ATB system from Final Fantasy and Chrono Trigger, and I believe from I Am Setsuna as well. And, you know, that's pretty fun. It was a great system, and it's kind of too bad that Final Fantasy got rid of it. But I've always enjoyed that. And there's also a component to it where you can get into these mech suits called Volko suits, and they have their own special abilities. And they can also smash through rocks on the map screens and things like that. But I have to say, combat in those isn't as fun as just relying on your standard attacks and special moves and items and things like that. One thing that is really cool about the game, though, is this mechanic of restoring the lost via memories. And you just get to these parts of the map where things are just all whited out and you can't progress any further, but you collect these memories as you're playing, and then you can use these to restore these parts of the map. And then after that, you can build landmarks in some of these spots, and they grant new abilities as well. Like, they can make your characters stronger at the expense of being weaker in magic, or it can be sort of like a system effect where it shows a mini map in the corner of the screen or something like that. And I really like the idea being able to affect the game in that way. However, just when it comes to this demo, though, it's rather short. It doesn't show anything very visually impressive. It's all just kind of brown and dusty. And there are some pretty cheap enemies, too. So, yeah, this demo kind of left me wanting a lot more, and not really in a good way. It's like, well, I want to see more of what the game is all about, but this demo didn't leave me feeling especially positive about it.
Lost Sphere doesn't look like something I'm likely to pick up. It's something that I would be interested in if the cost was lower, but this is also a $50 downloadable title.
That's
so
true.
That's not something I'm likely to jump on at that price. I see that there's an audience for it. I'm not saying it's not worth it for other people. If you love this kind of traditional RPG experience, that's great. But like you, Chris, I'm in a position where I still have many dozens of hours to go in Xenoblade Chronicles. And I have paid for the DLC for that, so I'm not likely to need this new game anytime soon.
And I'm not saying that the game necessarily is bad. I'm just saying that the way it was presented in the demo was not, I think, putting the game's best foot forward. For example, let's go back to what I was saying about the cheap enemies.
Mm.
Like, for the most part, you know, I went through it kind of easily, but then there was this really tough boss fight at the end. Like, this boss can charm multiple characters at once, and she kind of can inflict huge damage on multiple characters. And so the first time I fought against her, You know, she inflicted charm on everyone, and I was defeated really quickly. The second time, I tried to spread my party out, and she still got a couple characters with it, and the fight went longer, but she still got me. Then the third time, I just, like, went all out, used all my strongest attacks as quick as I could, you know, spread my team out, and I got, like, a super easy win before she was even able to use her charm attacks, so...
That begs some interesting balancing questions, but...
yeah. I mean, that was one of the things I had heard about I Am Setsuna, is that sometimes defeat would come very quickly and brutally, and that was one of the turnoffs of the game.
Yeah, yeah, that's true. There's, even in the beginning, there are some big challenges that don't quite feel fair. I also just didn't feel like Setsuna, and I would imagine would not be likely to think Lost Sphere, holds the same kind of appeal as something like Octopath Traveler. But how would you compare that?
You know, it's hard to say. I mean, I'm certainly enjoying Octopath Traveler more than I enjoyed Lost Sphere. But again, the Lost Sphere demo was just so short. And again, you're tossing it without any context that, you know, just going by the demos alone, Octopath Traveler seems far superior. But again, I would kind of like to give this game another shot. I'd like to try playing it from the beginning, see how they set up the story, see how they set up the characters. But... you know, the question is, will I have the chance to do that? Will I actually, you know, go in and pay the $50 to try this experience after the demo? It seems kind of unlikely, at least not anytime soon.
Well, it's also interesting that in the Nintendo Mini, they didn't even take 5 seconds to talk about this, where they did ease, mm-hmm. and they did mention the Dragon Quest Builders demo as well. So I wonder if Nintendo has somewhat low confidence in it.
Well, it could be. I mean, it's also a title they've talked about before, and it's not a first-party release. But anyway, the game comes out on the 23rd of January. It's not too far away. So, you know, if you happen to like the demo, you can pick it up then. Or if you're just an old-school RPG fan and you've already happened to blow through Xenoblade, then, you know, maybe this is worth picking up. But just based on the demo alone, you know, I'm kind of thinking I might take a pass.
Sounds good.
Speaking of Switch games, though... you have picked up some new stuff, and apparently it's a title that you like considerably better than I'm enjoying this demo of Lost Sphere.
Yeah, it's not a new game, but it is new for people on Switch, and that is Super Meat Boy.
Oh, nice.
Really enjoying this one. Really encouraged to hear from the devs that the Switch release is selling as well as the game initially did on its original release on the Xbox 360, which is kind of astounding.
Oh, wow. Yeah, that's very nice.
And it is, of course, a perfect fit for the platform. It's great because it's brutally hard action platform challenges, but resetting once you've died is instantaneous. So
very nice.
There's no frustrations over having it load or, you know, having any kind of resistance at all between dying and getting right back into the thick of it. It's a very simple art style, but again, that also is great for a handheld display. Everything is really clean and clear. It feels great both on the Joy-Cons and on my Pro Controller. And it also is nice to have right alongside the recently released physical version of The End is Nigh, which is also Ed McMullen. So I've been really enjoying both of those and kind of alternating play between the two of them.
All right. Very cool. Glad to hear it. Are there any new features in this version of Super Meat Boy for the Switch?
Not that I know of. No, I haven't run across anything that feels different yet.
Okay. Even so, it was a great game to begin with, so it's very good to hear that it successfully made the jump over to Switch.
Yeah, it also makes me really curious to see what they're going to do differently with the Super Meat Boy Run game.
Oh, Super Meat Boy Forever?
Yes, yeah.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to finding out more about that one, too. It's supposed to be coming out in the not-too-distant future.
Yep.
Meanwhile, over on the Nintendo 3DS, I've actually been playing some stuff over there.
Oh, cool.
Kirby Battle Royale comes out very, very soon. It comes out this Friday as we record this. And that is, of course, the multiplayer-focused fighting-style Kirby game. Have you checked out the demo for this one?
I have not. Is it online or is it local only?
Well, the full game will have online and local. The demo only has single-player mode and local multiplayer mode.
Interesting. Yeah, it is one of those games, again, that is just fallen victim to the I have a Switch so it's hard to go back syndrome.
Yeah, I understand that. I'm still getting a lot of mileage out of my 3DS though, so I was glad to pick up the demo and check it out. It's got some really great backgrounds, like there's this castle you get to in the introduction to the single player story mode that looks really, really great. It's not in 3D, there is no stereoscopic 3D in the game, so it's just 2D, but it still looks pretty darn nice for 3DS graphics.
That's really cool.
And the other thing that I'm really enjoying about the game is that the story is just so completely ridiculous. Apparently, the game begins, Kirby's just chilling out and relaxing, and he gets an invitation to King Dedede's tournament, and the winner gets, like, the world's greatest cake.
Huh. That is definitely strange. But as we know with Mario games and the like, you know, having a simple story sometimes is just enough to kick the action in gear.
Well, I mean, when it comes to Kirby, who is famously always hungry, I can imagine why the desire for the world's tastiest cake would get him to go out and go into a fighting tournament. But
yeah,
it cracks me up pretty good. I mean, it certainly would motivate me to go out there and fight all these bad guys if I'm going to get a giant cake at the end.
Well, let's just hope the cake's not a lie, though.
Indeed. The game has fairly simple play mechanics from what I've encountered so far, but it does seem to have a lot of variety. So there's a single-player story mode, but in this demo you only really get the intro tutorial. And then there is a battle mode, which you can do single-player or up to four players, and that has 10 different variations. Only three of them are in this demo, though. There's the regular battle arena mode, which is just, you know, a fight to the finish amongst four players or amongst two teams. There is an apple scramble mode where you have to collect apples and whoever gets the most wins. And then there's a little mode called Crazy Theater, which is this unique contest where you face rivals in these really quick challenges, like you have to stand on the correct answer to a counting challenge, or you just have to land hits on foes before the time runs out, or you have to, you know, dodge attacks before your time runs out. And basically just have to complete this really quick challenge, and then whoever racks up 10 wins first is declared the victor. And that's kind of different from other games I've played, so that was pretty neat. The other modes that I have yet to play include Coin Clash, where you grab coins while fleeing ghosts, Attack Riders, where you have to go for a ride in some vehicle and steal points from your opponents, the Rocket Rumble, where you fuel your rocket and then blast off, Robo Bonkers, which is a boss fight against a huge robot gorilla, Slam Hockey, where you shoot pucks to send your rivals flying, or Express, where you have to load ore onto a train and collect the most to win, and then a game called Flag Ball, where you must get the ball to your flag.
So then, as a kind of variety party game for multiple players, would you pick this one up, or the new Mario Party, or both?
Oh boy, that's a good question. Everything in Kirby is very focused on these combat play mechanics, and it seems like it'll have a more satisfying single-player mode. On the other hand, Mario Party has 100 great mini-games and more varied gameplay, but the traditional board game mode is kind of a bust. It's hard to say, especially since I've only scratched the surface of Kirby with this demo, but it's probably a toss-up so far.
So how is the AI if you're playing these mini-games solo?
Well, it has 5 levels of difficulty, and so far I've tended to keep it on the low side, which is to say it's been pretty dumb and weak.
Okay. Though that's partly on you, it sounds like.
Yes. So, I mean, I'm saying the AI seems to be appropriate for the difficulty that it defaults to. It defaults to 1 star, and I haven't cranked it up past 2, I don't think.
And you know, it's crazy, Chris, but I have found that as I'm getting older, I'm playing more and more games in easy mode.
Uh-huh.
Used to think that that was kind of the equivalent of baby mode. Now I just want to get as much satisfaction for my hour as possible. And if that means playing things on easy, so be it.
I can understand that. Aside from all these modes, the game, of course, also has a wide variety of Kirby abilities. You start with only the sword and cutter abilities in the demo, but you can also unlock the beetle ability. But then in the full game, there's also going to be spear, ninja, bomb, fighter, whip, parasol, hammer, doctor, tornado, and ice. So all kinds of Kirby goodness packed into this game.
That sounds great for Kirby fans.
Yeah. I mean, it's not a traditional Kirby game. The focus on fighting and combat is a little bit sort of un-Kirby-like, so I wasn't really sure what to think before I had played this game. And I'm still kind of unsure what to think because the demo is somewhat limited, but I'm liking it a lot more than I was expecting to. And I think I would like to give the full game a spin and try out the final release and see if it is, you know, worth keeping and getting.
That makes sense. And hey, it's not going to be that long until we get our proper Kirby game anyway.
Right, right. But it's much shorter for this one. It comes out, as I mentioned, in only a couple of days. So yeah, you can get a quick Kirby fix on 3DS if that's your thing.
Great.
But speaking of Nintendo 3DS, last week, after we finished recording last week's episode of the podcast, Nintendo made a nice announcement about 3DS, and that is Detective Pikachu is on the way.
Yeah, that's going to be a big one, too. And that amiibo, I know that you have had to catch them all in the amiibo department. Boy, that looks pretty cool, too, though monstrous. It could eat the other amiibos, I think.
Yeah, when you say it's a big one, you are not kidding. It is a giant Detective Pikachu amiibo.
Amiibo!
Yeah.
Yeah, and it's like, you know, two or three times the size of the Pikachu amiibo that came out for Smash Brothers.
Yeah, that's crazy. I wish you could scan it in and unlock a playable Ryan Reynolds for Pokken Tournament, rather.
Yeah, well, you never know. Maybe it's coming down the line. They just haven't told us yet. Probably not.
But that game sounds like an interesting departure. Is it Game Freak that's doing it or not?
I don't know who's doing it, and I really don't know that much about the gameplay either. All I know is that in this game, you team up with a, quote, witty, tough-talking Pikachu to uncover clues and solve mysteries. So does that mean it kind of plays out like, Professor Layton or something? Is it like a classic adventure game? I don't really know.
Well, it's definitely not your Ashes Pikachu, so...
No, it's not. And the amiibo apparently unlocks secret cutscenes that help provide hints to some of the mysteries of the game. So they'll have a significant function in there as well. But yeah, I will definitely be picking up the amiibo, and I'm cautiously optimistic about the game. I would like to know more about it before I decide for sure, but I'm very much intrigued.
Yeah. Well, I think also it's worth bearing note that this year and the very end of last year with 3DS releases, it's been a pretty strong clip of robust titles. And I think a lot of people are passing them by because they have the Switch. But what that means to me is that these titles are, first of all, more likely to be collector's titles down the line because they're going to be lower print and overlooked. Also just something that will be worth looking back at, like when you're looking at the best that the 3DS has to offer, having games like Monster Hunter World and Metroid and hopefully Detective Pikachu to say, wow, they really stuck the landing at the very end of this thing.
Yeah, I certainly hope so. As I mentioned, very intrigued to find out more.
Yeah.
In addition to the Detective Pikachu game and amiibo, there's also a new Nintendo 2DS XL Pikachu edition that is coming out. The game and the amiibo don't come out until March 23rd, but this new 2DS comes out on January 26th, which is the same day that Pokemon Crystal hits the 3DS Virtual Console.
So do you have as robust a collection of 3DSs as you do amiibo, Chris?
No, I don't. So I do not have the Pikachu Yellow Edition new 3DS that came out last year. That was kind of cool. It had a really neat sketch of Pikachu on it, but I do not personally own it. But now there is this new one, this new 2DS coming out, and instead of a sketch, it has basically Pikachu's face and rosy cheeks on a yellow new 2DS XL machine.
That's something that could be cute, but then again, if you would describe the N64... Pokemon machine, I would have said that sounded cute and it kind of looked like a hideous kid's birthday cake or something.
I would say it's definitely cute. I like the pictures I've seen so far, but I really like the new 3DS Pikachu edition much, much better. I think that art is way cooler. Plus, I'm just not a big fan of the new 2DS, not having the stereoscopic 3D, which I'm a big fan of.
As am I.
However, I was expecting that the new 3DS Pikachu edition would sell great, and by all evidence it did, and this new 2DS probably will as well. If there are any left by the time that Detective Pikachu comes out, they probably won't last much beyond that.
Makes sense to me.
Do you like it? Is there any chance you'd get it or your kids would get it?
Well, we now have three Switches in our house, so I think we've full-on switched to the Switch, and as I mentioned to you before the show, my $250 just recently went towards getting a 400-gigabyte memory stick for my Switch, so I am out of funds for that, unfortunately.
Okay, understandable. In other Nintendo 3DS news, Atlas has announced a release date for Shin Megami Tensei Strange Journey Redux. It is coming out on May 15th. Do you have any interest in picking this up, despite your switch to Switch?
Yeah, I think really, for me, Shin Megami Tensei is most interesting when it is Persona. Mm-hmm. And so, I will try the next proper Shin Megami Tensei on Switch, which is 5, right?
Yes.
Yeah. I'll go for that. This new game, I think I'm going to skip just again because I'm playing Xenoblade. And there's only room for one RPG at a time for me.
That's understandable. Did you play the original Strange Journey when it came out on DS?
I did not, no.
Okay. Yeah, I played it just a little tiny bit, probably for preview purposes or something like that. But it seemed like it wasn't, really my kind of RPG.
Okay.
So, yeah, I'll probably end up passing on this one, too, but remains to be seen.
Yeah. Was it the type that you kind of had to create your own maps to keep track of what was going on, that level of intensity?
I don't think you had to create your own maps, but I remember it was some pretty challenging dungeon crawling.
Okay.
And also, for 3DS owners, Nintendo has put out three of its greatest titles as Nintendo Selects. You can now get Super Mario 3D Land, The Legend of Zelda, A Link Between Worlds, and Ultimate NES Remix for $19.99 each.
If you don't have any of those three games, you got to get them at that price. That's absolutely incredible. And that's even if you have moved over to Switch but have a 3DS knocking around in your closet. Those games are so good.
Well, I definitely agree with you on two of those. I would say that Super Mario 3D Land and The Legend of Zelda, A Link Between Worlds are, very possibly, the two best games on the system.
Yeah.
They are absolutely fantastic. Ultimate NES Remix, I can't speak quite as highly of, but it's definitely a good game. I mean, personally, I prefer the Wii U version over the 3DS version, but it's still a pretty cool title.
Yeah, especially since it has not been announced yet for Switch. And while I assume eventually we'll get some version of that series on the Switch.
Why not? Everything else does.
Yeah, exactly. For now, getting it on 3DS would make sense. And yeah, those other two titles, you're right, those are the best of the best.
Yeah, I mean, if you don't have those, gotta go grab them. Now they're on the cheap.
Yes.
No reason not to.
Yep.
And now for something completely different. Just a couple hours ago, as we record this, Nintendo made a somewhat surprising announcement of a new product for Switch called Nintendo Labo. Is that how you pronounce it? Nintendo
I believe
Labo?
So, yeah.
Nintendo Labo? I don't know. Anyway you pronounce it, it is a bit of a strange new product that goes back to Nintendo's roots as a toy company. It sort of taps into some of that expanded audience energy that Nintendo had seemingly realized wasn't paying the bills anymore. But, now they are back into it. They aren't even talking about the game software yet. They are just showing lifestyle photos. And it's kind of reminding me of the early days of Wii where they just had to show people, taking in the fun and not really necessarily playing the games, because this is all about cardboard constructs called Toy-Con. You take these sheets of cardboard and you fold them up and you create things like a fishing reel or a musical keyboard or a little house or a motorbike steering wheel or these little remote-controlled cars, or are they even cars? Like remote-controlled bug creatures. Anyway, you make these things out of cardboard, you insert the Joy-Con and the Switch screen into these, and then the Joy-Con's IR motion camera reads what you do with these cardboard constructs, and you use them to play a variety of games. It's unlike anything I've ever seen. It's very bizarre. What do you think of Nintendo Labo, Ethan?
Well, again, as a father of two, I have an 11-year-old daughter and a 7-year-old son. This is absolutely perfect to me. As I am talking to you here, I am looking around our living room and seeing lots of different cardboard constructions that the kids have made. I am looking at lots of drawings. This is just a perfect extension of what we do as a family. So I believe 2/3 of the fun is actually going to be everyone sitting around the table and starting to construct a different part of the toy set.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that has to be considered when you're looking at the total experience. That's not...
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, it's not a means to an end to put this stuff together. It's like Lego. It is part of the end in itself.
Yeah, I absolutely think you're right. And I totally think that that's the kind of audience they're going for. I don't think they're going for you know, a solo gamer like me. I think they're going for families. I think they're going for kids. I think this is the kind of thing that they're going to want to see promoted in like parenting magazines and things like that.
Yeah, I think Nintendo has done just such a great job of targeting two very specific audiences this generation. The lapsed gamer, the person who no longer has time in their busy schedule to sit down and play television games, mm-hmm. and kids, who generally tend to also be in a position of having to fight for the TV and are increasingly going towards their own screen. So instead of having a dedicated tablet or a dedicated phone as a hand-me-down, I think a lot of kids are getting Switches and having a vastly better experience when it comes to games as a result of that. And I think that this is just such a playful, fun, cool way to bring those two audiences together as a family and enjoy it. I would be hard-pressed to see the, you know, 20-something Call of Duty fan get in line to buy this kit and get much value out of it. But, you know, I think for the right audience, it's going to be something that is much more compelling than, say, Wii Music.
Yeah, I think you're probably right. And that's not to say that, you know, Nintendo hasn't been doing great with their other audiences as well. I mean, I think for core gamers, you know, they've shown that they've really been paying attention and delivered awesome games that, you know, appeal to, you know, the hardcore long-term fan, you know, Zelda, Xenoblade, Splatoon, Mario. And so, you know, having had such success with, you know, going back to their mainstream roots, I think there is also room for them to put out something that appeals to the expanded audience like this.
Well, I think also what you have to look at is the Wii ended up, and to a different extent the DS, carving out the audience that would eventually become the mobile gaming audience.
Right. Yes, exactly.
But once mobile came in and everything was free, it doesn't matter that the App Store and the Google Play Store is effectively just one giant pair of competing casinos. You know, the games are free. And for a lot of people, that's enough, even though the games are demonstrably a lot worse than anything that mm-hmm. you would buy on the eShop.
Yes.
But here, you know, you have something that is totally different. It's a totally differentiated experience with a physical good attached to it. And mm-hmm. that's really novel. You know, we haven't seen anything like this since, you know, maybe the Google Cardboard, which itself was kind of a neat application of screen with a cardboard device.
Now, for me, this kind of fulfills the unspoken promise that we had at the beginning of the Switch's unveiling, that you'll be able to do all sorts of crazy things with these Joy-Cons. You know, they're detachable, and what can you attach them to? You know, we were kind of imagining they'd attach to all these various controller peripherals, but instead of going that direction, Nintendo's having you put them into these cardboard constructs. And so instead of having a special 6-button arcade controller, or attaching to, you know, plastic musical instruments, you're attaching them to a cardboard, you know, fishing reel controller and a cardboard musical instrument. So I think it's kind of like, you know, a more affordable way to get some of those cool peripheral ideas out there.
Yeah, definitely. And again, the joy that you have in actually constructing your own stuff, you know, a Lego Millennium Falcon may not be as structurally sound or as realistic looking as something that it comes pre-constructed, you know, as a model kit. But that feeling of building it yourself actually means more. Same thing with IKEA or anything like that. So, yeah, I just think that this is something that is going to offer a lot of fun from the moment you open the box to the time you end up completing your run on the Switch and move on to whatever Nintendo's next system is. I think people get a lot of fun out of these.
Yeah, I think you very well could be right. And there are two full-fledged sets on the way. The first one is the Variety Set for $70, and that includes all the stuff that I'd already been talking about, the fishing reel, the keyboard, the house, the racing wheel, the RC vehicles. And then there is the Robot Kit for $80, which is this weird, funky-looking big backpack thing with a headband and hand grips and ropes that connect to your hands and to your feet. And it's very bizarre, and you're almost like, you know, controlling yourself like some giant marionette, and it will then translate into controlling a big clunky giant robot on the screen, apparently. It's pretty wacky looking.
Yeah, for sure. And think about also like how smart it is from a cost of goods standpoint for Nintendo. They're not going to be paying that much for these quote-unquote peripherals to be stuffed in the box. Mm-hmm. And they're charging, what, $20 premium on top of the regular price of a game?
Well, it's 70 for one, 80 for the other. So, yeah, 20, 30 bucks. And then they're also selling a customization set with stencils and stickers and tape rolls you can use to decorate these things. And that's, you know, $10 of profit right there.
That's really smart. And we'll certainly buy all three of those packages.
Yeah, it's very, very interesting. And I would love to know more about the software and what the games are actually going to be like that you can play using these things. But so far, that's not something Nintendo's talked about. I'm sure we will find out a little bit more about that. But we really don't have that long to wait because the thing comes out on April 20th.
Yep, absolutely.
My one concern, though, is that, you know, it is made of cardboard. We are talking about something made for kids. It's not a sturdy plastic peripheral. And my fear is just that if this isn't really sturdy, hardy cardboard you're talking about here, these things could get wrecked kind of easily. And that is my one big worry about this Nintendo Labo project.
Well, also bear in mind, you're talking about kids and having them house these Switch machines, in this cardboard.
Right.
So, you know, the potential for the actual device to get jostled and for it to fall out of the device is high. When I was playing around with Google Cardboard, back when I was working at Sega, we were handing around the device, and sure enough, within 5 minutes, my phone hit the concrete because, it slid out of the cardboard holder. So,
yeah, I don't have any experiences like that, but I remember when I first got my NES, I kept all of my NES games in the boxes and just, taking those in and out of the box, on a daily basis, using them, those got really thrashed really easily. Obviously, this card will be a little bit more substantial than an NES game cartridge box, but, it still makes me worry about how it's going to hold up for the long term.
For sure. I hope that it is relatively easy to get replacements for that very reason. You'd think that people would want to buy extras anyway to just decorate them differently.
Yeah, that's a very good point as well. Anyway, it's interesting, it's weird, it's wacky, it's a quirky but somehow appropriate new direction for Nintendo, and I'm very curious to see how it all ends up.
And just like Nintendo always does, it's something you've just never seen before that only makes perfect sense after Nintendo has demonstrated why.
Yep, very much so. All right, this seems like a good place to take an intermission, so let's do that, and then when we come back, we will discuss this week's big topic, which is localization. All right, we are back, and we are ready to discuss this week's big topic, which is video game localization.
That's a big topic.
Yes, it is. But it's also one that seems to come up a lot. It can be sort of a hot topic at times. But it's also one that has evolved a lot over the past 30 or so years. We have come a long way in video games since A Winner Is You and Congratulations, This Story Is Happy End. But I think there's still a lot to be said about localization. What makes a good localization, what makes a bad localization, and what we hope companies do and don't do to deliver enjoyable games that were originally created in a foreign language.
It's also the different house styles. I remember growing up how different, for instance, the Working Designs localization felt compared to
yes.
other ones, like contemporary references to Alf and stuff like that in Lunar.
That's sort of the reason why this is one of my topics of interest. I did spend a year at Working Designs. I loved what they did. That's what attracted me to the company. I was a big fan long before I was an employee. And they were arguably the first company that really prioritized localization and making a game that was not only well translated, but also culturally relevant and featured quality voice acting. Back then, it seemed like a lot of publishers didn't care and they were content with things like all your base art belong to us. Now, however, there are a number of publishers that specialize in that sort of thing, like Axis and Xseed and NIS America. And of course, Nintendo's Treehouse has a great track record as well. But it's not easy. You don't just dump the script into Google Translate and get a great game. There's a lot of stuff to consider, like finding the right tone and the right voices for characters.
Well, and the other thing also is, of course, all of the different culturally relative jokes and references that can be kind of important to understand. What do you leave? What do you remove? What do you adjust?
Yeah, exactly.
And for which audience? Like an audience that is going to be playing Yakuza, they know that they're getting a game that is set in Tokyo. So they are okay having things like, you know, hostess clubs and karaoke and stuff like that. Whereas if you're making a game that is intended for a more mass market audience, you may adjust that a bit.
Yeah, very much so. And, you know, I think, you know, this brings us to what would be sort of my list of what separates a good localization from a bad one. You know, things that make a good localization. I would say that staying true to the spirit of the original game is probably the ultimate thing that you want to do when you're localizing a game.
Yeah.
You know, as you were saying, it's very different if you're talking about a game like Yakuza or a game like Super Mario Brothers.
Absolutely.
It should be appropriately entertaining, you know, for whatever language it's in and whatever genre it's in. You know, it should be dramatic if it's that kind of game. It should be scary if it's a survival horror game. It should be funny if it's a Mario and Luigi game or whatever. It shouldn't change the tone of the original. It should stick to that. And it might change a lot of other things, but as long as you're sticking to that spirit of the original, then it's probably going to be a good localization. And then, of course, on top of that, there should just be the fact that it is well-written, it sounds natural, and that it reads very well, or in the case of spoken dialogue, that you know, it's just well-performed.
Now, sometimes those things do not mesh up together very comfortably. And what I mean by that is sometimes being totally faithful will make for a product that is not necessarily as effective in communicating the intent of the message.
Oh, I totally agree. I know some gamers would like things to be just a straight-up, faithful, literal translation all the time, but in my opinion, that's often not the best option.
You know, humor is very different.
Yes.
One of the most bizarre and eye-opening conversations I ever had, I was in a room once with Sonic Team, and we were talking about, while I was at Sega, Sonic Boom, and making clear that sometimes jokes and humor that would be funny in the West will not seem funny to people in Japan.
Mm-hmm.
And so we were showing them clips from Phineas and Ferb. I don't know if you've ever seen that show.
I haven't, but I know of it, of course.
Okay. So there's a rap in one of the episodes that's called Squirrels in My Pants, and it's ludicrous. A girl gets a squirrel stuck in her pants, and she's, you know...
No, we've all been there.
Yeah, right. She's trying to get rid of it. And everybody at the table that was Western was laughing out loud. Everybody that was Japanese was not. And they did not understand what made that sequence funny because it wasn't funny to them.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, it became a matter of building trust and saying, look, sometimes when we'll do a localization pass or when we'll take these characters, in the case of Sonic Boom, and put them onto television for a Western audience, we'll do things that you might not feel is funny or might not feel is exactly in the spirit of the character as you would define it, but we're converting it for a Western audience to ensure that it is funny and nuanced and clever for that audience, you know?
Right.
So, yeah, that's sometimes the balancing act. And in both cases, it requires a lot of trust on both ends, rather.
Yeah, I mean, totally, absolutely. You don't necessarily want to translate the joke directly, but you want to translate, you know, the spirit of that scene. You know, have a joke or a reference that is appropriate to your audience. And yeah, there definitely has to be a trust between teams like that, like you said.
Yeah.
But, you know, what do you think ends up making a bad localization? If you were going to, you know, give me a list of things that add up to bad localization, what would be on there?
Well, I think oftentimes localization is looked at as a mechanical exercise instead of an art. And so sometimes when people are just trying to do things so literally, so directly, I think about the translation work done in, say, Shenmue. And literally spoken, Ryo might say, have you seen any sailors around here? Or Lucky Hit. Would you like to play a game of Lucky Hit? How about Lucky Hit? That may be literally what the translated word says, but You have a couple issues there. The first is lucky hit doesn't necessarily mean anything to Western players, even though you're set in that case, China, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, it still might not make sense to Western players what that is. And also, again, it's like it's not a nuanced translation. So it's direct so that it's functionally correct, but it doesn't sound like a human talking.
Right. Yeah, I mean, for me, I think that's one of the most important things is that it does end up sounding natural.
Yes.
That's possibly the key thing, or definitely one of them, anyhow.
Yeah, and with that, when that's done correctly, you can get games like Persona 4, where you have characters that just over the course of, say, dozens of hours, you just truly fall in love with. And, you know, playing Xenoblade Chronicles 2 right now, I think that that's an interesting one because my understanding is that Nintendo Europe did the localization for that.
Yeah, apparently so.
Yeah, so that means you have some Cockney in there. Some of the characters sound like they're almost from Liverpool, you know, and they sound like they're, you know, out of Guy Ritchie movies because it's the actors and they have the British accents too. And it makes me wonder, like, I think the translation is good. I know not everyone loves it, but I enjoy it quite a bit.
I think it's pretty solid.
Yeah, and I wonder how different it would be if it was the U.S. that had done that. Like, how would all American actors and writers made that same treatment feel very different?
Yeah, it's a very interesting question. Good point. I mean, I feel like the way it's written probably wouldn't have changed so much, but obviously a lot of the accents and dialects would probably be very, very different if it had been done over here in North America.
Which changes who those characters are. I would say also it's interesting to note that if you're doing a subtitle, the rules are a bit different than if you're doing a dub, where I remember when I first played Shenmue 2, I played the European version on the Dreamcast, which was all subtitled. And it sounded so much better to me in the Japanese language. As it turns out, not necessarily because the Japanese voice recordings were particularly good, but because when you're reading something and you don't know exactly how it's spoken in a different language, it can come off as sounding more profound or, you know, grounded or rich than if you actually understood the language itself. Have you ever experienced that?
I haven't experienced it personally, but you know, hearing from a lot of people who always prefer the subtitled versions, I've often thought that was the case.
Yeah.
But I guess going back to my question, you know, are there any other things that you think are you know, particularly egregious in localization, things you definitely shouldn't do? I mean, obviously, you know, it would be the opposite of the things we were talking about before. You don't want to change the tone. You don't want to, you know, alter any story points.
Yes, I think that that's definitely a part of it. I think also there's, as I said, you have to consider the audience. If you're making something that is clearly going to resonate very strongly with an audience that has an appreciation for Japanese culture, you can keep more stuff in than otherwise. A mass market game, I mean, you know, you have the dirty old man trope. You know,
yeah,
and that type of thing tends to get toned down. There are other things that, you know, you see frequently in Japanese games that are either kind of rewritten or removed. One thing that I do think about, I remember Roger Ebert reviewing Final Fantasy: The Spirits Within.
Mm-hmm.
And you had this weird case of, you know, there was like a character that was like an old character with like a young person's voice, like a Ben Affleck voice or something like that. And he said that, you know, the weird feeling of like hearing a duck moo,
yeah,
you know, that type of thing, where it's just like the vocals did not match who the character was. And that can be challenging for sure.
Yeah, yeah, that's an aspect of vocalization I don't think about too often. But, you know, it's something that can come up because sometimes you could be working on a game, you don't really know what this character looks like. You know, you might be surprised to discover, oh, I'm writing for a woman. I kind of just assumed it was a guy or something like that. So, yeah, yeah, those issues, I can totally see how they would come up. Yeah, I guess it just helps to be able to actually see the stuff in context. And yeah, those are definitely things that would be nice to avoid if possible. Is there anything, you know, personally that you like or dislike in localization? When you see it in a game, I mean?
I do like when you have certain themes, especially if they're philosophical themes, issues of, you know, money and power, or, you know, the way the world works in a cyclical way, things that are kind of more focused on Eastern philosophy,
mm-hmm.
that gets rooted into the Japanese games where they're made and carries over to the localization. It's really nice sometimes to be exposed to new ideas, new philosophies that you wouldn't otherwise get access to in more Western content. A good localization team can keep that stuff intact and keep it interesting. You know, you think about Metal Gear Solid, and you know, its messages about war and sustainability, and I think they do a really nice job taking on very serious topics and keeping it grounded and making you leave the experience feeling like you would finishing a great book, where you had a good time on a moment-to-moment basis, but you have you know, something to carry away and think about that maybe changes your mind on a larger topic. And you tend to get that more in Japanese RPGs, say, than you would in Western RPGs. And I think that's oftentimes the source material, but also the hand of really strong localization artists.
Yeah, you make a very good point there. I mean, a lot of this does come down to the original source material. And sometimes if I'm reading something that's really brilliant in the game, it's like, oh, was that, you know, really that amazing in the original Japanese? Or is this the localization job that made it seem so profound to me in English? Sometimes it's hard to tell.
Yeah, yeah. And I think that that's always the thing. It's like, you know, you will find in the world of literature, if somebody is, you know, a good translator, the work of, say, you know, like a Nabokov or something like that, like, you know, some people will take that language and translate it very literally, so you are getting as close to, you know, the Russian as possible. And others are more lyrical with it and capture more the flavor, and, you know, you get a more readable version that is actually closer to the spirit of the book. And I think games are exactly that same way.
Yeah, I think I definitely have to agree with you there. Another point it reminds me of is that sometimes if you're doing a great localization job, it ends up being something that you don't even really think about. It doesn't you'll really stand out. Maybe if you're doing a great job at localization, it just seems, you know, so completely natural that you never even, you know, really think about all the effort that goes into it.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think sometimes the very best localization jobs are the ones that are invisible in that way.
So speaking of, you know, some of these great localization jobs, what would you say are some of your favorites on Nintendo platforms and why?
Well, I'll go with contemporary right now. I'm finding that for many of the reasons I just described, Xenoblade Chronicles 2 is really, really pulling me in. That game just has a lot of interesting messages on power and loyalty and trust. And, you know, it has a long, you know, story to tell, and it gives you hours upon hours of cutscenes to tell it. Mm-hmm. But in addition to that, you have the characters carrying on with banter while they're fighting, and it's, you know, usually pretty interesting and meaningfully tied to the characters. And you just have a feeling of this whole world that is part the, you know, creative work of the Japanese team, but also clearly part of the European localization team. And the two come together really well. So that's, on a contemporary level, I think one that does it very well. Looking back at earlier games, I think a lot of the humor of Earthbound was something that I always really enjoyed and appreciated localization standpoint. What about you?
Oh, boy. Man, there's a whole bunch of them. Let's see. One of my favorites would definitely be 999 for the DS.
Oh, sure, yeah.
It just had some really deep, well-written characters with very unique voices. It also had a whole bunch of complex concepts, kind of what you were alluding to earlier, and it just had a really good way of explaining those and making it sound all very, very natural.
Oh, and actually, before you jump to your next one, because I'll forget it if I don't say it, but announced for and coming to the Switch is Steins Gate, which is also a terrific localization of a visual novel.
Oh, I did not realize that was coming to Switch. Mm-hmm. I have played through that on other platforms, and I do really like it. There is one thing I would love for them to fix in the localization. They had these horrible line breaks. For some reason, it would often break on apostrophes, of all things. And you know, that's not really the kind of thing that I necessarily think about when it comes to localization. It's just like this little minor thing that must have been in the scripting somewhere. But for me, it really held back the experience when I played it on other platforms. So I definitely hope that gets fixed.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Other than that, yes, you know, in general, I really love that property. And I'm very impressed by what the teams have done bringing that over to North America. Another one of my favorites, though, would be the Professor Layton series.
Mm.
And, you know, I'm pretty sure that at least the versions I've played were localized here in North America, even though it is set in London. And they did a fantastic job finding just the right tone for that character and that world. And, you know, it's very unique and different, and they're able to make Layton seem, you know, very gentlemanly and intelligent, and yet also very, very likable, just in the way that he speaks and the words that are used. And I think that coming across properly was key to that series, you know, finding an audience here in North America.
For sure. Was that Treehouse or was that Level 5 that was doing the localization? Do you know?
I believe that was the Treehouse for the first six Layton games. I think the most recent one was Level 5 itself.
Okay. I mentioned that just because tying to that, I think that the Treehouse team is incredible, and I love what they've done with the Mario and Luigi and the Paper Mario RPGs too. So much humor.
Yes, yes, that's obviously on my list as well.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, they've really, really nailed it in pretty much all of those games. And, you know, the highlight for me would probably be going back to Fawful and his bizarre way of speaking in the first Mario and Luigi game. And it's just so wacky and bizarre, and just the way he would phrase things, you know, really helped sell the humor in that game. I mean, there's lots and lots of humorous moments, but, you know, him coming out and talking about the Mustard of Doom and all that stuff is an all-time classic that was really, really well done.
Oh, yeah. And you know, Luigi saying the L stands for winner and stuff like that.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm willing to bet that a lot of that stuff was not directly translated, but, you know, it fits perfectly.
Absolutely.
Yeah, when it comes to good Nintendo translations done, you know, at the Big N itself, you know, this one, you know, goes way, way back, but Link's Awakening on the Game Boy, it had a really simple translation. It was pretty lighthearted and fun and kind of goofy, but for some reason, it's really stuck with me through all the years because I thought it just worked really, really well for this bizarre setting, you know, basically a dream world that Link finds himself in. And so when you have, you know, these goofy characters yelling, Yahoo! And, hey, I'm going to get, you know, stuck up in the mountains later. Come and visit me. You know, it just was really charming and, you know, worked quite well in that setting and context.
Yeah, for sure. Well, also, you know, I think we'd be remiss not to bring up Chrono Trigger.
Mm-hmm.
And Final Fantasy III or Final Fantasy VI, you know, which you can play on the SNES Classic, I think is also a really lovely translation as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, as I recall, both of those were done, you know, sort of faster than they should have been. And I think the translator had some regrets. But for me, I thought they were both great at the time. They still hold up very, very well.
Yeah, I agree. And I think one of the things that's really important to look at there is that the games both move you. You know, they have moments where the characters, you really feel close to them and you get, again, the same feeling of reading a great book. And that is very powerful, especially since it doesn't happen that often in games.
Oh, yeah, for sure. Going back to The Legend of Zelda, though, another one that really stood out to me was The Wind Waker.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
Specifically, the part at the end of the game when Ganondorf is giving his speech and, you know, talking about, you know, living in the desert and, you know, how basically the winds and the cold meant death. And it was just, you know, this very poetic presentation that has really stuck with me through all these years.
Yeah, I think that's a great one, too. And I think the ending is really solid. The beginning, also, the way the team brings out the dialogue between Link and his sister and his grandmother. And, you know, we get a character that feels more real than any Link before or arguably after, because you get that kind of feeling of family connection, and a lot of that comes through in the writing.
Yeah, I think that is all very true. A couple other of my favorites are the Animal Crossing series, just because it's got so much quirky, humorous, and all-around, you know, solid writing for, you know, such a wide variety of characters. And then Kid Icarus Uprising, which has a fantastic sense of humor with that snappy banter. And again, I'm sure that's all stuff that existed in the Japanese version, but, you know, making it all work in English just as well, you know, was very, very impressive.
Absolutely. Yep, that's true.
And then, of course, another one of my all-time favorites that's sort of a special case would be the Ace Attorney series.
I was hoping you were going to bring that up. I didn't want to bring it up first because I know that's your specialty.
Yeah. I'm a huge fan of the Ace Attorney games. I have played through all of them pretty much multiple times. And it's a game that, you know, is controversial in its localization in a lot of ways because, you know, the character had a different name in Japan. All the characters had different names in Japan. The game had a different name in Japan. The setting was different. And, of course, there's the famous changing the ramen to hamburgers.
Right.
But this game really wouldn't have, you know, been able to come out to the West without having all those changes made, because so much of the game is dependent on words and wordplay and having these puns in the names. And, you know, you're conveying all that stuff in just a couple of lines. And there's so many jokes and puns that had to be fully localized and changed. And if they hadn't been able to do that, you know, this game would have just fallen flat on its face. We probably would have, you know, maybe had the first one and then never gotten another installment. But it is a huge credit to the localization team that they were able to make all that stuff work.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, that series, and again, it's like it requires a kind of a steady hand, and it's something with these very intricate stories where you're looking for clues, and it's important to get that just right, and I think you're right, they did.
But of course, you know, it's got that whole awkwardness where in the Japanese one, it's set in Japan, and in the U.S. version, in Phoenix Wright Ace Attorney, it is essentially set in California. And that leads to lots of bizarre stuff, like, why are there so many Japanese temples here in California? Huh, that's very odd.
Yeah.
But again, if everyone's going to have an English name, which they kind of have to do if you're going to have those puns and those jokes in there, it only makes sense for it to be set in the U.S. If everyone had an American name and it was set in Tokyo, that wouldn't make any sense either. So,
yeah.
You know, I understand why they did what they had to do. And I think in the end, it ends up, you know, working out beautifully. It'll be hard for them to have come up with a better job than they did.
Yes, yeah, absolutely. Oh, and one issue that can sometimes come up with translations, and I will, since I'm going to be a little critical here, I will protect the innocent by not naming company or game names, but I remember playing an action game, you know, a few years back where I could only presume that the localization was handled in Japan and not in the United States, because the way the characters used swear words sounded like the people who wrote it saw a lot of Martin Scorsese movies and understood that gangsters talked like that, but couldn't get the syntax or language down to make it sound elegant or realistic. And so it just came off as really goofy. I don't know if you've ever seen things like that before.
I have. This rings some sort of bell, but I feel like it's something that I've pushed deep into the recesses of my memory and I'm trying to never remember again, but this does seem vaguely familiar.
Yeah, it's just one of those things where I think oftentimes what Japanese localization teams will do when they are trying to write for a Western audience is they don't know how Western people talk, not to the level, of course, that a real Westerner would, but they've seen lots of Western movies.
Mm-hmm.
And so then they get some of the wrong cues from that, and it comes off as a bit painful.
Mm-hmm. So going back to Ace Attorney and games that are like that, where they've had to make these significant wholesale changes, you know, what's your overall feeling on stuff like that? What's your feeling on, you know, changing Rockman into Mega Man or changing Owendon into Elite Beat Agents?
So I think it all comes down to, is the end product good? I think that the difference between Mega Man and Rockman is totally arbitrary, and I could see as a result why people might get annoyed with that, but Mega Man, it was great. I think it, you know, was a fitting name for the character, and that is how I know him and knew him, and that is totally fine with me. I think that, you know, something like Owendon, that name would be very hard to get Target to say yes to carrying and stocking that game. Elite Beat Agents is just a little bit more familiar. But remember with that, they also changed the music. So you had like...
Right, exactly. And that was kind of my point, is that, you know, they, for that game, it wasn't just a simple localization. They completely, you know, changed the characters. They changed the music. They basically just kept the core gameplay concept the same and did a wholesale rewriting. And I think that in much of the same way that Ace Attorney needed to, you know, get, you know, totally refitted for North America, I think the same thing goes for Elite Beat Agents. Just, you know, that wouldn't fly over here without totally getting a facelift to make it more appropriate for the U.S. audience.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think it was effective too, because I remember there was a Chicago song that was tied to the story of the little girl who loses her dad.
Uh-huh.
And that was, I mean, the combination of that music, syrupy as it is, and that story, blunt as it is, worked really powerfully and brought me to tears. And
that freaking one gets me every time.
Absolutely. And that is, again, one of the more powerful examples of a localization team choosing the right song. I mean, if you listen to the lyrics in the song, it doesn't really make any sense that they're playing that song, right? Mm-hmm. But it still is the right type of music and hits you, you know, like a brick. It's powerful.
Yes, very much so. Yeah, I mean, it's not like Elite Beat Agents, you know, set the world on fire commercially, but, you know, the critics love it. Everyone who actually went and played it loved it. And, you know, I think that the audience would have been, you know, that much smaller if they hadn't gone ahead and put in these Western songs and Western scenarios that ended up in the final product.
Yeah. It is also likely to me that games that do not feel Western enough will likely struggle to find shelf space in places outside of GameStop.
Yeah, that's somewhat true. Sometimes that's unfortunate, sometimes it's fair.
Yeah, yeah. I think that people who are completely open to, you know, these highly Japanese games like Nioh or, you know, Bayonetta, you know, have no problem with how Japanese they are. But, you know, I think that the Japanese titles that feel universal, like Mario or Zelda, are the ones that tend to sell better worldwide. It's, you know, there has always been the challenge the other direction too, Chris, where, you know, when you're trying to bring U.S. titles to Japan and make them culturally appropriate and relevant to Japanese gamers, think about the changes that happened to Ratchet and Clank, for instance.
I don't even know about the change that happened to that.
Oh, look up Japanese Ratchet and Clank, and they are these crazy kind of anime versions of the characters.
Huh. Interesting.
Yeah, yeah. So, you know, it can be really tough to break through into those territories, too. And part of it is that, you know, the Japanese game culture, you know, and products are more advanced, generally more mature. They're several years ahead of us, or at least have been, you know, for a long time. But still, it's like, you know, it's a struggle either way to make something that feels culturally grounded in a, you know, different part of the world.
Oh, right.
That, I think, is one of the things that makes Mario and Zelda so remarkable, is that when you think about Mario, you don't think about it as a Japanese character, even though it has earmarks of Japanese game development all over the place.
Yep, this is very, very true. Yeah, making something with universal appeal like that is quite an accomplishment.
Pokemon as well, of course.
Now, let's go way, way back to one of the earliest, you know, controversial localizations, and that is the U.S. version of Super Mario Bros. 2. Obviously, it was a completely different game in Japan. They got a different Mario 2. You know, looking at it, you know, from our perspective, you know, all these years later, you know, do you think they made the right choice? Was that the smart thing to do?
Oh, for sure. I think that it's nice that we've been able to get Super Mario Brothers to the Lost Levels. Mm-hmm. You know, we got that, if I remember correctly, the first time we got that was it in All-Stars? Is that right?
Yes, that's correct.
Okay. Mm-hmm. It's not a great game. I'm not saying that...
Well, it's a super challenging game. It's very, very hard and kind of infuriating. And, you know, my thought is that if that had come out instead of the Super Mario Bros. 2 that we got, it really would have turned off a lot of players. So
it sure would.
I think that you know, Nintendo really pulled a rabbit out of their hat by saying, yes, let's just take this other unknown game that, you know, never would have sold at all without, you know, the Mario characters in it, and turn it into something with you know, this great cast that people are going to love. And so it was like win-win all the way around.
Yeah, I think maybe retrospectively what would have perhaps made more sense would just have been to call, because Super Mario Brothers 2 had a subtitle, wasn't it like Mario Madness or something?
Well, that was written on the box of the U.S. version. I never really thought of it as a subtitle, so to speak. I remember the subtitle for the Japanese Super Mario Brothers 2 was like, you know, for super players or something like that, which it was.
So what I would submit is, I think retrospectively what would have made more sense would be for that game to be called something like just Mario Madness or something, where it's like, it's a Mario game, it's the same characters, but actually waited for Super Mario Brothers 2 until we got what we ended up calling Super Mario Brothers 3.
Yeah, that would end up with a Final Fantasy-like situation.
We would, but only for one game. I mean,
that's true.
You know,
that is true.
Because then it sets back at Super Mario World. Because I think that that is the one thing that is strange, is that it is not a Mario game.
No.
It's a great game. I like it a lot. But from a naming convention standpoint, it would have made more sense to me to not use that naming. And for some reason, they ended up doing that again with Super Mario World 2. Yoshi's Island,
yes.
Which that is so clearly not a Mario World game.
Right, right.
And it doesn't diminish the importance of the game at all that it isn't. It's a spinoff, you know?
Mm-hmm.
But I think it's interesting because by putting that 2 next to it, it does make the game kind of more canonical interest and value. But then again, you know, you never see Wart come back. You never see any of those mechanics return.
We've seen a lot of characters come back, though.
Shy Guys and stuff like that, yeah.
Yeah, Shy Guys, Birdo.
Yeah.
They're around.
True.
But yeah, at the time, you know, if the internet had existed back then, you know, people would have been so mad we weren't getting the real Super Mario Brothers 2.
yeah, that's true. That's true. But I think
would
that
have been furious.
It also says a lot that Nintendo was looking out for quality and had a really good sense of what that was. Because remember, back then, there were very popular games that were really bad. Like Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles is probably my favorite example of that.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just, like, I can't believe that got through any kind of QA process. But Nintendo didn't let that happen with their games. And Lost Levels kind of bordered on that. So just like getting Super Mario Brothers Versus, it's like that's also brutally hard. And it's an interesting curio. It's interesting to look at, you know, with context. But those games are not good torchbearers for the most important brand that Nintendo has.
Yeah, that's a pretty good point. So I got a couple questions for you revolving around this whole you know, change in localization thing. Do you prefer Princess Peach or Princess Toadstool?
Oh, okay. I prefer Princess Peach. That's what I am now used to, so I'm fine with that.
I'm kind of used to it too, but I don't know. I think I might have to be on the Toadstool bandwagon. What about Proto Man and Blues?
Oh, Proto Man.
Yeah, I'm with you there. And what about Eggman or Dr. Robotnik?
Haha, that's interesting because I have, you know, raised my kids. My son right now is the biggest Sonic fan.
Mm-hmm.
He thinks
and of
Sonic...
course, you were at Sega for many years, which is why I ask you this question.
Right, yes. Internally, we were always to call him Eggman once that transition happened.
Mm.
But in the privacy of my own home with my own kids, it is Robotnik.
I want to get a t-shirt that says Robotnik Forever on it.
Yeah. I just think that's a much better name. I think that was a good decision from a localization standpoint. I'm glad that Dr. Robotnik's Mean Bean Machine exists because, you know.
That's right.
Yeah, there's a headliner game with that original name. But what do you think?
Oh, I'm definitely on Team Robotnik. I mean, like I said, I would get that t-shirt in a heartbeat. But, you know, Eggman, a lot of times, just uses an insult because of the shape of his body. So it seems like, you know, he'd want to be called Dr. Robotnik. I mean, they've then made it clear, you know, Dr. Robotnik was also the name of his father. So that is his name. Eggman is a nickname and not a particularly nice nickname. So, yeah, Robotnik forever. I stick to that.
Well, so then I would have to ask you, King Koopa or Dennis Hopper?
Between those two, definitely King Koopa.
Oh, man. Yeah, I mean, it is interesting to look at those kinds of differences. And I wonder how people in Japan take to, you know, these different naming conventions, even when it comes to consoles, right? I would find when I was at Sega, you know, just kind of very fluidly remembering if I was in Japan or Europe to always say Mega Drive instead of Genesis, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Or Famicom, you know, instead of NES.
Right, right. Yeah, that reminds me of the time that I was talking to Yuji Naka about the anniversary of the NES, and the translator translated as Famicom, and he got very upset with me because, you know, the 20th anniversary of the NES and the Famicom were not the same. And so he thought I was off by a couple years. And I know I mentioned this on the podcast before, so I won't go into it any further, but yeah, he was about to, like, get out of his chair, I think, and strangle me until someone clarified.
Yep.
Okay, so moving on to a different localization topic, what do you think about you know, pop culture references or memes being in a localized North American game?
That's an interesting one because in the immediate, I think it's fine.
Mm-hmm.
But over time, I think it's the same problem you have with movies. I can guarantee you that the Aladdin remake that's coming with Will Smith will not have any Arsenio Hall jokes.
Yeah, that is probably true. And yes, I think I agree with you for the most part. I mean, I think, you know, if they're there in, you know, the original work, again, then I think that's fine. You should translate it into something that works, you know, better for America, put in some sort of goofy American meme or reference. But yeah, overall, in general, I do think that a timeless localization is best. It's not something you should go around and try to insert into the game if it isn't already there. You know, if the game is set in a specific time and a specific place,
yeah,
and you want to hearken to that, then, you know, using some lingo or meme or something that refers to that is totally fine. But if you want your game to not maybe sound passé in 6 months, then it's probably best to not go that way if you can avoid it.
Yeah, I think that that's true. Though, at the same time, when I was talking about working designs at the start of the conversation, I did like the contemporary references. I thought that they were funny and made the game feel less stale than a lot of its competitors. But then again, I think that was during a very early time in which even, you know, major works from Square were being translated without that much nuance.
Well, yeah, with working designs, you know, like I remember the Wheaties reference in Lunar, and, you know, that one seemed timeless enough that it totally worked for me. But then there was the Clinton reference in Lunar 2, and that just totally took me out of the experience. Not because necessarily it was a pop culture reference, but because it was a pop culture reference that never should have occurred in the world of Lunar.
Yeah, yeah, that's a bigger one.
And I'm like, why would they be talking about that political figure in this world that has nothing to do with, you know, contemporary 90s America? Makes no sense.
Yeah, I think that that's very fair. I mean, you know, if you're playing a game that's set in the 80s and they make a reference to the Goonies or something, that makes sense.
Sure, sure.
Yeah, provided it's on Earth.
Yeah. Yeah, another game that kind of stood out to me as, you know, maybe having too much of that kind of stuff was Advance Wars 2. And I don't remember the dialogue specifically, but I remember some of the characters were just using these very, you know, popular phrases of the day that by the time the game came out, you know, a few months later, I'm like, oh, wow, this already seems dated. You can tell when this was made. Maybe it was funny then, but not so much now.
Yeah, that's a risk for sure.
Yeah, I remember I gave them a hard time about that in the review, and then that was just before I started working there. And then they're like, oh, so you think that our dialogue is deader than disco, huh? Okay, then.
Yeah, that can be tough. Actually, a story I can now share. When I was at Game Now magazine, I gave a very controversial review of the remake for PlayStation 2 of Shinobi. I gave it a C-.
Uh-huh.
I thought that it just didn't look very good and the mechanics were pretty punishing. And it was getting much better reviews everywhere else. So then, not 6 months later, I was working at Sega in PR. And one of my very first responsibilities was to do PR for Nightshade, which was the spinoff to Shinobi.
Yes.
And, you know, it was getting not the best reviews. And Bryce Baer, who had done the Shinobi original PR and had since moved on to EA, sent me a note with, you know, some of the negative reviews of Nightshade. And he just said, not so easy, is it?
Yep, yep. That crow, delicious.
Yes.
I will say that there are times when you put that sort of thing in a game and it works really, really well. Like, you know, there are characters in some of the Mario and Luigi games and also in the first Ace Attorney that are like all leet speak. And, you know, to me, it's like sort of a timeless thing. And of course, a parody of, you know, what real people talk like. So that actually works for those specific characters and those specific scenes. But, you know, if you were doing it like with just your average character, then it would be, you know, totally out of place. But, you know, it works when it's done appropriately, I would say.
I would agree with that, yeah.
Well, just so Advance Wars 2, you know, doesn't feel like it's being called out specifically, are there any other localizations where you just like to complain about something to get off your chest?
You know, apart from, like, just some of those very early samples from the NES era, you know, finishing POW and seeing it say, congratulations.
Yeah.
Or, you know, Metal Gear's I Feel Asleep.
Mm-hmm.
You know, some of those things that you just can't believe, even at that phase in development, got through. Yeah, there's nothing that strikes me as kind of a pet peeve game, really. Again, maybe you know, some of the dialogue in Shenmue I would go back to just because it's such a good game. I'm somebody who is, I think, uncharacteristically a lover of Shenmue, but you know, actually hearing the dialogue is a little bit painful because I think the localization is the weakest part of what otherwise was a really ambitious and incredible experience.
For me, if there was something I could go back and fix localization-wise, I think it would be The Legend of Zelda Ocarina of Time.
Oh, listen!
Not that. Specifically, just one little part. It sort of connects to what I was saying earlier about how much I love Ganondorf in Wind Waker. And that's the part when Ganondorf crosses paths with Link in Ocarina of Time, and the words out of his mouth are, "You want a piece of me."
Oh, sure.
And every time I read that, I'm like, man, I just cannot imagine, you know, philosophical, poetic Wind Waker Ganon, you know, ever saying something like, "You want a piece of me?" And I just can't really imagine anyone in Hyrule saying, "You want a piece of me?" It's always seemed so out of place. And I know it's a little thing, and I don't want to harp on it too much.
Well,
but it was something that always stood out to me as feeling a little off.
And some of those, like, you know, I would be prone to point out some of the, you know, early PlayStation, you know, stuff like Symphony of the Night, you know, What Is Man? Miserable little pile of secrets. Or, of course, Resident Evil 1. You almost became a Jill sandwich and you're the master of unlocking. I mean, that stuff's all very goofy. But the truth is, and I wonder where you land on this, sometimes those are so bad that they do become a thing of legend. I mean, you know, I remember playing on Switch the Resident Evil Revelations 2, and Claire, I believe, is talking to Jill, and, you know, she says, "Oh my gosh, I almost became a Claire sandwich." And Jill's like, "Ah, does Barry tell everyone that story?"
Well, at least I got a good sense of humor about it.
Yeah. So how do you feel about those kind of notoriously bad translations that are so bad that they're good, that they become a part of our pop culture, that they're a meme unto themselves?
Well, I mean, ultimately, you know, it would probably be more pleasant for everyone involved if it had gotten a more appropriate localization to begin with. But at least I'm glad that people are having fun with it and are able to, you know, laugh at themselves and enjoy it in the long term. I guess that's really all I can say about that.
Yeah, yeah.
One last little topic I wanted to bring up before we end this discussion. You know, what are your thoughts on the times that localization involves removing or changing a part of the game that really isn't crucial like it is in something like Ace Attorney? I'm talking about, you know, in Xenoblade Chronicles X, where you have had the chest configuration slider removed for custom female characters, or in Tokyo Mirage Sessions, where the background with the bikini girls is taken out.
You know, it's interesting you mentioned that, because if you had asked me that question 12 years ago, my answer would be different than it is now. But having an 11-year-old daughter that's dying to play Xenoblade Chronicles 2, actually, you know, Pyra's bust is kind of a problem. You know, I kind of wish that had been toned down a little bit, even as I understand other people might feel like that's some form of censorship. You know, I think it's good to have player options. I think it's nice when you can to, you know, be able to filter things in the downward direction. You know, when you're talking about sliders, I'm assuming that's to make characters more jiggly instead of less, but
I think that you could have a whole wide variety of body shapes, but in Chronicles X, you only had one.
Okay. It's a tough thing, right? It's like I'm picking up Bayonetta 2 in February, and that is arguably my favorite Wii U game. Hmm. I absolutely love Bayonetta 2. I think it is a masterpiece. But boy, when she uses her supers and she just gets stripped naked and nothing's covering her but her clothes, and they have all sorts of, like, you know, camera angles that are designed to accentuate that, you know, I can deal with it because I know what it is and I'm going to be playing it and it's not going to be played on the big TV when other people are there. But I could also live without that. You know, I wouldn't mind being able to toggle that to something a little bit more discreet. So I think for the audiences that want it, it's important to be able to let them see the game as it was originally intended. But it's nice when it's possible to give people the option to scale it back a little bit. But that's the dad in me. What do you think?
You know, I was prepared to go all out and say they should never change this sort of thing for any reason, and that's why they have M ratings and things of that nature, so that you know, people don't experience that before they should. But I think you bring up an excellent point, and being able to just, you know, toggle that stuff on or off, you know, just if you don't want it as a player would seem like a completely reasonable option to put in there.
Yeah, I mean, it's like you remember the old days of, like, you know, if you could toggle the color of blood from red to green, you know?
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, that does make sense from a accessibility standpoint, you know, for the player. But take it out entirely, when you do have the rating, seems kind of goofy, especially in the context of games like Pokemon, where there are tons of characters running around in bathing suits and swimsuits and bikinis, and these games are rated E, and nobody is scarred for life, and everybody is okay with it. Just, it seems like sometimes they, you know, take it a little far. You know, why is it unacceptable in a totally otaku game like Tokyo Mirage Sessions, but it is acceptable in other works? So, yeah, it's just kind of weird that way.
I think it's also interesting to look at, you know, I'm a Vita collector as well. So, you know, I have the Criminal Girls games, right?
Oh, okay.
And those games were very, very heavily censored for the West. And that, to me, actually seems a little bit silly, because if you're buying a Japanese Vita game called Criminal Girls and it's rated M, you know, it's like, just give people the game as it was intended. It's like, you know, that's like censoring a Russ Meyer, you know, movie or something like that. It's like, it's a cultural artifact, and that's just a part of its form, you know?
Yeah, it's not like it's going to accidentally wind up in the wrong hands and be like, oh, I didn't know what this is. Now I'm offended.
Right, right. But I guess I just feel like where I'd like to see a toggle is in games that could otherwise be a little more mass market. So again, on the one hand, you can play it as it was originally intended if you so desire. But, you know, again, something specifically like Xenoblade Chronicles, you could have a younger audience, you know, be able to play it. And it's just such a good game that it would be great to broaden its appeal.
Yeah, I guess that would be a reasonable middle ground. Honestly, it seems like a feature that should be there from the beginning, not added in during localization. But if that's the way it happens, I'd be fine with that. And with that, I think this brings our discussion on localization to a close. I suppose that means we should be wrapping up this week's episode. But before we go, there is one more thing I'd like to bring up, and that would be a dramatic reading.
Please do.
This week, it comes from Nintendo Power issue number 1. It is their preview of Dragon Power. This exciting adventure game is based on the classic Chinese story, Shi Yu Qi, Monkey. There are lots of kung fu-like movements. You begin deep in the mountains, where Goku and Nora start their incredible mission to find 7 crystal balls. Ahead lies a long, dangerous, and fantasy-like escapade as the two search for the crystals. The journey takes them through sultry deserts, deep into caves, and through battles with incredible monsters. But if they succeed in finding and claiming the crystal balls, Goku and Nora will be granted one wish by the Dragon Emperor. And this wish is their ultimate goal. Will they make it? Only time and many adventures will tell.
Wow, that may not have been as intense as Rambo, but still, would definitely get me clamoring to get to KB Toys.
Yeah, you know, I wasn't really thinking about it when I chose that for the reading, but that is a perfect example of early game localization. You know, that was before anyone knew what Dragon Ball was over here in North America. So, like, oh, sure, let's just change a game to Dragon Power. Let's change Bulma's name to Nora. You know, just make this completely different from the property it's based on in many ways.
Yeah, that's true.
And that ends up sounding like something totally unexpected. Of course, it's accompanied by a hilarious picture of a dragon saying, "I'll make all your dreams come true, Goku," which really sells the game, especially.
Yeah, it's still remarkable to me to think about, like, what it must have been like back in the day where you had development teams of 10 or less people working on games with 6-month to 9-month, you know, development schedules. Crazy.
Yep. Yeah, it's a different world back then.
Yep.
All right, that does it for this week. As always, you can find us at powerpros.podbean.com, and you can follow us at PowerProsPod on both Facebook and Twitter. You can follow me, The Hoff, on Twitter at ChrisTheHoff, and you can find Ethan at Ethan_Einhorn. You can email us at powerprospod@gmail.com, And if you like the podcast, it would be great if you told your friends about us. Thanks for listening, everybody. For myself, Ethan Einhorn.
Thanks, man.
And our secretary / camp manager / personal advisor, Isabel. We will see you next time.